You know why? Because you're a psychotherapist. So
That's
I'm just
right.
going to
You got
have
to
all my,
analyze what you're doing
you're
with
going to
your.
analyze everything. Exactly. Do you find that you do that, that you start analyzing people when you meet them randomly?
No, I don't think I analyze them, but I think I probably tune into my hit, like we all do. I think we all do that, like what do you feel like when you're with that person?
I always get into coach mode. Like I was talking to somebody earlier today, and at the end of our conversation, I was like, "This is what I would do with it if I was, your business coach. This is what I'd tell you." And I was like, "I can't believe I just did that." But it's so natural; it just
Right,
happens. It happens
right, right.
organically. All right, we're recording everywhere. Everything's working, so here we go.
Great.
Welcome to Gratitude Geek, the relationship marketing podcast for micropreneurs building genuine, lasting relationships with clients, colleagues, and community. I'm your host, Candice Rodarte, and today I'm joined by author and psychotherapist. I forgot to ask you if it was love it or leave it.
Love it.
Love it. I'm your host, Candice Rodarte, and today I'm joined by author and psychotherapist, Phyllis Lovett. As an author, Phyllis brings a wealth of experience to her literary endeavors. With over 30 years as a psychotherapist and a master's degree in psychology and counseling from Antioch University, she has dedicated her professional life to treating children, families, and couples. After specializing in addressing abuse and dysfunctional family dynamics, Phyllis retired from her psychotherapy practice, shifting her focus to writing. Phyllis has authored three books, A Light in the Darkness and Into the Fire, and recently completed her latest work, America in Therapy. Welcome, Phyllis.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here and talk with you today.
I have a lot of opinions about why America needs to have therapy.
Go for it.
But we're going to start with your story. How did you get to where you are today?
Well, I think like so many people, I gravitated toward a profession that really spoke to me personally. I had some trauma in my own childhood that I kind of reached a peak of needing some help for when my children were small. And actually, the whole early part of my life was very difficult because of that. And no one talked about psychotherapy when I grew up. And then when it started to get talked about, it was sort of like, you don't really need that. What does that mean about you if you go talk to somebody about your life? And finally, I did go to therapy in my 30s. And it was really a life-changing experience for me. I didn't even have the concept, which I think is maybe more common now. But at the time, I did not even have the idea that our early conditioning really affects the rest of our lives, that the role models we have in our family, the early experiences we have with other people really shape how we feel about ourselves, the coping mechanisms we come up with, the attractions we have, the repulsions we have, and I think also has a lot to do with like the fulfillment of one's self-expression. And by that point in my life, I was very happy to be a mother, but in every other aspect of my life, I was really pretty miserable. So therapy really opened the door for me to look and see what happened in my childhood. And I began to remember some of the things that I had buried. And it was just really life-changing for me. And I won't pretend that it was an easy process. It was not an easy process, but it was so worthwhile. And I was so hungry for the truth about myself that I was willing to do that. And I eventually kind of came out the other side and began a, a real healing journey. And then I had a big aha. And that was that there are millions of people like me out there. I felt so alone, but actually I wasn't alone. There are many, 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 countless people who are suffering, who have no access to help, who don't know that there is help, who wouldn't go for help. Or people, in war-torn countries who that's not even a possibility to escape the trauma. And it began to dawn on me what a serious problem trauma at the hands of other people is for the whole human race, not just for myself, not just for America, but for the whole human race. And out of that was my next big aha, which really led to writing the present book that I just finished called America in Therapy. And that big aha was that, and this came out of my own experience, and it came out of years of working with, hundreds of clients, many of whom had extremely difficult childhoods in their families of origin. And so the next big aha was that everything that I had learned about family dynamics and family therapy and dysfunctional families and abusive families, I saw happening in the family of America, that from the top down, many of our policies and practices that come down from government and the largest institutions of power in our country, including some of the biggest businesses that have control over the lives of so many people, that some of those dynamics are just like abuse family dynamics. And I felt like I had to write about it. I felt like I wanted to bring everything that I learned as a psychotherapist and as a client myself into public knowledge. And so that's really why I wrote the book. And of course, you know, the other half of why I wrote the book is that there are so many things we have learned treating people, treating families, treating individuals who have suffered at the hands of other people. There's so much we've learned about how to heal and how to break the cycle of abuse. And I, you know, more than anything, that's what I really want to bring both to individuals and to our country. And really, it's global.
This is a business and marketing podcast, and I cannot tell you how many times the subject of childhood trauma has come up on the show.
Oh, I'm actually relieved to hear that. Not because I want there to be childhood trauma, but because I think we need to know how rampant it is. So go ahead.
You know what? You said something that a lot of people don't ever do. And you said that you wanted to know yourself.
Yeah.
A lot of folks don't want to know themselves. They just want to put on a facade.
That's right.
And we see that on Instagram every day. People are being fake. Like, you know, when really that's not, I mean, my husband tells me he was attracted to me because of my flaws, not because of my perfections.
Beautiful.
You know, so
really your uniqueness. It's not even flaws. It's just who you are as a unique human being.
Exactly. And so being authentic is, I think, and figuring out who you really are, you know, I mean, I'm sure that you know that personal branding is this new thing that, well, it's not new. People have been doing it for a while, but they go to these personal branding specialists and they follow the advice that these personal branding specialists tell them that they need to, who they need to be. And it's nothing like who they really are.
I think we live in a culture, unfortunately, that is very surface oriented. And that there's a lot of pressure to appear a certain way, to only express certain things, to always look good. And I know that even without anybody ever telling me that, I grew up feeling like I couldn't show my real self and that I had to like pretend like I had it all together. And I think a lot of people do that out of fear that their real self won't be liked, that their real self won't be accepted, or that their real self will even, you know, inspire some kind of attack or shame or blame or some other kind of discrimination. And so that's the culture of our country. And I call that the family of America. And part of what I want to see happen and what I speak to is how can we change that culture, that we make it safe for people to be themselves, and not only safe, but that we encourage and love it when people are themselves, like your husband loves you being who you are.
Episode 196, I chatted with Paige Arnoff-Fenn. She's a marketing maven. And she was talking about back in the days when she worked for Procter & Gamble, they would do, you know, they'd have people come into a room and I can't remember what it's called now. Product focus groups. She would work with focus groups about makeup colors. Mm-hmm. And so they would get these group of young women, teenagers in, you know, early 20s, they'd get them together in a room and they put the new ideas for makeup out on the table and tell them that they could play with the makeup. And inevitably, there would be one person in the room who would be the leader, the person who emerges with all the opinions. And then everybody else in the room would agree with her. So I'm just going to use, I don't remember the exact, if it was sparkly or matte, but so the leader said, oh, I love sparkly makeup. I love blue eyeliner. I love, you know, hot pink lipstick. And right. Everybody else in the room agreed with her. I do too. But they had cataloged all the makeup that was put on the table. And then after the event was over, they looked at the makeup that was left. And the young women had stolen all of the boring colors and the non-sparkly makeup, and left the sparkly makeup and the blue eyeliner on the table. So mm-hmm. they said that they liked something because the woman with the big personality liked it.
What a fascinating study.
Yeah. Well, and that goes to what you just said, though. People try to be somebody else,
right?
Who they think that you want them to be.
Right. And so, you know, part of the healing for ourselves and our country is to be that person who loves and accepts people the way they are and appreciates people the way they are and expresses that. You know, that's, we can all do that for each other if we even know to do it.
Yeah.
Because I know, and you probably know, and I think most people that are listening today know how good it feels when somebody actually sees and appreciates you for who you are and isn't expecting you to be somebody else.
I was just having a conversation this morning with a coaching client. She's Catholic, and I am a universalist. If you aren't familiar with that religion, it means that I believe that every religion is the right religion for you. Mm-hmm. For the people that practice that religion, it is the right religion for them, right? And she was talking about how people just can't get along anymore. And then she joined a book club. It's a Catholic book club, and they were reading a book called Letters from a Catholic to an Atheist. I think that's the name of the book. In the show notes, there'll be the correct name of the book. I will do that research for you, audience. If you are curious about the book, the correct name will be in the show notes. But anyway, I said, that'd be interesting. Does the atheist write back? And she said, yes. They haven't started reading it yet. But people just can't have conversations with each other like that anymore without fighting with each other. And this, you know, this is an honest and, you know, calm and peaceful dissertation between two people. And I was like, well, you're a Catholic and I said atheist, but I'm not an atheist. I said, you're a Catholic, I'm an atheist. We're having a cordial conversation right now. People of different religions have cordial conversations all the time until they find out what each other's religions are.
You know, and it speaks to me, and this isn't the only thing, but I think it's really important in our country today that many of our leaders are completely intolerant of another opinion, and they're role modeling that for the whole country and mm-hmm. for young people. Instead of respect for another opinion, an openness to learning something new, the idea, which I think we actually all need to survive here, is that all of our contributions together are actually what we need.
Mm-hmm.
No one person has the whole answer. No one person in a family knows what's best for everybody. We need to be able to listen to one another and have multiple perspectives and multiple sources of information. You know, I had hoped that COVID would be the possibility of that for the world, really, that we would face this danger and say, let's come together and all work together for a cure. And I think we lost that opportunity. It became highly competitive. It became highly politicized. And people did the same old thing of being very divisive and attacking. And I think, though, that that's where we're moving and we need to move, honestly, if we're going to survive here.
I agree with you. There were some amazing things that happened during COVID, some fantastic advances in technology. I mean, within 6 months, the world fast forwarded 10 years, if not 20, in terms of technology in some cases. And then in other ways, we went backwards 30 years. You know, they always say that two steps forward, one step back. But,
right.
You know, it is about perception and belief systems and tolerance. And so I want to know the solution.
Mm-hmm. You know, and it's funny because, you know, I call the solutions that I know from the world of psychology and psychotherapy, I call them the answers lying hidden in plain sight. It's not really new what we need. It's that we don't talk about it and we don't employ it because it's actually harder to wage peace than it is to wage war. It's easy to fight. It's easy to be angry. It's easy to attack another person. It's much harder to restrain yourself and tolerate the distress that you feel when someone doesn't agree with you or doesn't want to meet your needs. So, the main reason, or, you know, one of the main reasons why I wrote my book is because there are so many answers lying in the world of psychology. First of all, the whole world of psychology is not partisan. It's not about taking sides. If a couple comes to therapy and they're having a really difficult time with each other, the therapist's job is not to side with somebody. The therapist's job is to help them hear each other, to help them grow empathy, to help them restrain some of their not so pleasant behaviors and learn how to listen, you know, the way, and I say it this way all the time. And again, this is sort of like the answer lying hidden in plain sight. I don't know anyone who doesn't want to be heard, but we don't know how to listen.
Yeah.
So we don't know how to give to other people what we want for ourselves. And so one of the jobs of really good psychotherapy, when it involves more than one person, is to help people really learn to listen, to tolerate their distress, to hold back and really hear the other person with depth, the way they want to be heard, because that's actually what brings people together. The goal is to reconnect. We all suffer from how disconnected we are, how much anger we have, how much isolation we feel, how misunderstood we feel or misused we feel. What we really want is safe connection with other people. That is the best food for human beings. So I wanted to bring the world of psychology to the world of politics, the world of love and belonging and understanding into the world of politics, because it's the big missing.
Two things. I don't know who the author is, but there is a quote that says that we need to learn how to listen to understand and not to respond. Mm. We need to learn how to listen to understand rather than listening to respond. Right. And so that is a completely different thing, because the whole time that people are talking, if you're trying to figure out how you're going to answer them, you're not really listening to them.
It's so true. And it's actually one of the skills we work with in therapy. And we tell people that exactly what you just said. Your job when your partner is listening, or your child, or whoever it is, your job is to really try to enter their world and hear them and leave your reaction to the side. You will have a chance to speak later, and you will want to be heard the way the person talking to you wants to be heard. And we really actually teach people those skills. And I would love to see there be trained facilitators in government, in Congress, mediating the conversation, holding people to account, to be respectful, to not walk out of the room, to not filibuster, you know, to actually listen to their side. And can I throw this in real quick?
Absolutely.
When I was researching for my book, I came across an organization, and I don't know if they still exist or not, but I read an article about an organization called the Better Angels. And it was just a nonprofit organization that brought people from different parties together to listen to each other. And they had amazing success. And there was a woman that I quoted in my book who said, you know, when we actually sat down and listened, we realized we weren't that far apart, because we were human beings and we're all Americans. And I think we desperately need that in this country.
Yeah, we do. Okay, I'm going to make my first comment before I lose it, and then we'll move on to the next one. I often tell people, I mean, I say it a lot, that it is harder to stay married than it is to get divorced. And I see in the current political, you know, I'm a very proud American, but I see in the political spectrum right now, people who want to divorce this country. They want to separate this country into two countries. They want to have a divorce. And that's the easy path.
I agree with you. That's why I said, I think war is easier to wage than peace.
Yeah. The harder path is to figure out how to communicate with each other and settle on something in the middle and not have to have your way 100% of the time. And to understand that not everybody agrees with you, and that's okay.
And there is never going to be that everybody agrees with you, probably, you know, unless you're saying, do you want to drop a nuclear bomb or not? Or though, I don't know if everybody would agree with that, but you know what I'm saying? Like, it's the nature of human beings that we don't always agree, but we don't have to have a war. And the thing is that people are happier when they're not at war with the people that they care about or that they interact with every day, their bosses, their children, their friends, and themselves. We're actually happier, but it takes a lot of strength. to restrain yourself and actually try to work it out with someone. So I agree with you. I think staying married and staying married successfully and gratifyingly is hard work. That's worth it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And staying together as a country is hard work, but gratifying. It's a beautiful, all 50 states are beautiful.
Right. And you know? I feel the same way as you. I'm happy to be American. I love America. And I love life. And I want there to be a life that's safe and rewarding and fulfilling for our children and grandchildren and all future generations.
Yeah. I feel like I had a better childhood than my daughter did.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that sad?
Well, I think, you know, I think a lot of people are suffering in this country today and worldwide. But, you know, talking about America, yeah. A lot of people are suffering. A lot of parents are really stressed. A lot of people don't know how they're going to make it, or they didn't have good role models that they can pass on to their children.
Yeah. Well, they're turning schools into prisons. And, you know, schools are supposed to be a place where you learn and you enjoy learning. And if you feel like you're in prison, you're not enjoying any of it. And I mean, so that's one of, there's so many things that could be fixed,
I know.
You know?
I think that's a really good one, if you don't mind my saying that. What's so beautiful about the world of psychology, and one of the many reasons why I want to bring that into more national conversation, is that it's about real solutions. Bringing armed guards into schools may protect them from, you know, the next mass shooter, but it doesn't get to the root of the problem of why there is a mass shooter who would want to come into an elementary school in the first place.
Yeah.
These are huge societal problems of deprivation, of abuse, of neglect, of discrimination.
Yeah.
If you read some of the stories of the people who have perpetrated some of these atrocious murders, you know, they were seriously mentally harmed by their environment and their upbringing.
Yeah, and they were victims who turned into predators or whatever the word is.
That's right.
They churn the I don't know the right phrase. You're the psychotherapist. I'm not, but they just, yeah, you know, there was a shooting here in Michigan, in Oxford, Michigan, and a kid came to school with his mother's gun, and he had been picked on and bullied, you know, but he's the murderer.
Right.
And instead of helping him when he was being picked on and bullied and turning him into a murderer, I mean, the same thing happened to the transgender, I think it was a transgender woman. I might not have my facts right. In Kentucky or Tennessee, she had been picked on and bullied, and so she turned around and bullied back. You know, right. Why do we have to bully people so hard that they want to murder you?
And why do we have role models in our society of people in power who are bullying on a very large scale and very publicly in the social media and in the news media, because they do set an example that this is okay to do.
Yeah.
But I think the larger problem is that so many people feel disempowered and unseen that they fall prey to the bully on the playground. You know, they want to identify with some feeling of strength and belonging. And if there's no healthy place to do that, then some people will gravitate toward the bully and feel, you know, some vicarious sense of power by being, you know, the one who's the aggressor rather than the one who's being victimized. And I see this escalating in our country as a trend, and it really worries me.
Me too. It's like the Bible says, love thy neighbor. Why aren't we doing that?
Exactly.
Why aren't we doing that?
The whole world, there's one sentence that would probably solve everything if we were actually to live it. And I remember learning it in grade school and probably writing an essay about it when I was in third grade or something. And that is, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Mm-hmm. It's as simple as that, and mm-hmm. as hard to do as obviously it is hard to do.
Some people are masochistic and they want people to be mean to them. So I like the platinum rule better, do unto others as they want you to treat others the way they want to be treated.
Perfect. You know,
yeah.
And I think people who really don't want to be treated well, for it's a mental condition. It's an emotional disturbance that would cause someone to actually want to not be treated well.
Yeah.
So we don't get born that way.
Yeah. I, many, many years ago, I You ever heard of Abraham Hicks?
Yeah.
Okay. Great advice. Fabulous advice. I really love listening to her advice. But I'm skeptical about where the advice is coming from. You know? So with that in mind, years ago, her husband was talking about a girlfriend that he'd used to have. And she had been in abusive relationships. And when they broke up, she got to be really obnoxious. She was like writing with lipstick on the mirror and stuff. And he realized that it was her that was attracting the abusive relationships, that she was behaving in a way that would attract that kind of response. So going back to what you said at the very beginning, you wanted to identify why you were the way you were.
And I would say about, you know, I was attracted to unhealthy relationships. And I think, you know, these are known psychological principles. I'm not making this up. You can read about this in some of the great books that are written about relationships and attractions and all of that. And that is that we tend unconsciously, a couple of things, to be attracted to what we know. So if you were abused as a child, the chances are very high that without any intervention, any help, any insight, any rescue, any treatment, you will either be attracted to this, to what you know as abuse, or you will become that person yourself. And it's not a person's fault. These are understandable reactions to being victimized and not being helped. And I think we have to understand that the person who looks like they attract the abuser actually is caught in a psychological cycle of repeating what they know. And it's tragic because it gets then handed down often to their children and it gets passed on. And it gets, you know, today with social media and the influence we have on people, you know, that we don't even know around the world, these dynamics get spread like wildfire.
Is there a way to fix it?
Well, I think the beginning, you know, and everybody says that. And of course, I don't have a one size fits all answer, and nobody does. And I have my one small part to play, and you have your wonderful part. You know, I think the fix is us, as many people as possible, making their contributions to a healthy society. And one of the first things, which I think podcasts today, and I know a lot of podcasts sprung up during COVID. So it was one of the blessings of COVID that people were stuck behind their computers and they decided to talk, you know.
There's a lot more noise now. When I started my podcast, there was maybe 300,000 shows. Now there are 3 million, 3. Probably. You know, 4 million. Probably. Yeah.
But I think the first line of defense is education. I think a lot of people really have no clue how their own psychology, their own emotional and mental makeup is running their lives, and how, in particular, their unhealed wounds are running their lives and the lives of other people. So to me, it starts with education. Obviously, you know, getting help somewhere, whether it's from a therapist or a friend, or, you know, having a safe place to express your art or connect with nature or animals or whatever, you know, certainly psychotherapy is at, you know, there at the top, I think, of one of the interventions that is most helpful. But we have to have some safe place to go. And for many people, they need some safe place. And myself was really included in this, some safe place to tell our story and not feel judged and not feel blamed, but actually to have someone safe there who sees our essence and holds that light, even if we can't see it ourselves.
How do we fix that in a world where people accuse public schools of being woke and want to be anti-woke? How do we do that? Because what you just said is woke.
Well, I'm proud of that. I think there's so many dynamics to talk about here, but people who are abusive or addicted to their own power and control over other human beings don't want the truth to come out about the effect they're having, and the danger that they are, or the damage that they're doing, and they don't want to lose control. And so they will put down anyone who speaks truth, who calls out the offense. And this is one of, you know, when I said I was looking at the country through the lens of family dynamics and seeing that a lot of our dynamics are like the dynamics in an abusive family. That's one of the dynamics, that the person who tries to go outside the family and tell somebody there's abuse going on, or there's, you know, persecution, or someone's being starved, or someone's being ostracized, or someone's being raped, or whatever it is, that person is often the target of attack and shame and blame, and, you know, they're discredited. And we're doing that as a society. And that whole thing about woke is, for me, is a societal impulse from a certain part of the population to put down the people who are really calling out abuse on a societal level.
I have an example of government, of this in a small government, just for the listener's sake, to an example in a small way, right? So I live in a town of about 25, 30,000 people, surrounding area, maybe 60,000 people. And the town is having a resurgence right now, a huge resurgence. At one point there were, it was one of the richest towns in Michigan, and now it shrunk and came back and shrunk and came back, and they've done a lot of stuff. They completely tore down the downtown area, you know, the charming 1800s downtown area. There was a fire, and then they rebuilt it, and then they tore it down and they rebuilt it. So we don't have the charming 1880s downtown area that other Michigan towns have. We have a hodgepodge of different types of buildings. But they're trying really hard to make the downtown area more hip. We also have two lakes, Lake Michigan, which is ginormous, and Muskegon Lake, which at one point had been had been so polluted that you couldn't even boat on it, right? And so it's been cleaned up. And so now we have this beautiful small lake and this gorgeous big lake, and the town is taking advantage of the fact that it's got these beautiful lakes, and it's building for tourism. Back in the day when it was still an industrial town, they had built this parkway to circumvent the downtown area. And they had built this parkway to circumvent the downtown area. And it's four lanes, and most of the traffic that goes from the freeway to people's residences goes through the parkway. Well, the speed limit on the parkway is 50. It circumvents downtown by a block, right? And most people just don't ever stop downtown to have a meal or anything. They just go straight home. And then the other problem is it separates the lakefront from downtown. So it's impossible to walk from downtown to the lakefront the way that the road is currently set up. And the city wanted to shrink the road to two lanes so that it could open up walkways and bike paths, which is a very noble thing to do. But they didn't communicate it that way. They communicated it that they were putting the road on a diet. And they put up all these orange cones, and they brought the road down to two lanes, and everybody was mad. You know, they were mad about how much money they were spending on this thing, but the city never communicated up front, the reason why we're doing this is so folks downtown can walk to the lake. We have this gorgeous lake. Nobody can get to the lake from downtown because of the way the road is currently set up. And so the people didn't listen to them, and the city didn't communicate well. That's what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
That is what's going on. We have a family in dysfunction, and the family just happens to have 60,000 people in it.
Right. And if just as policy, we had trained facilitators and we opened up meetings, and this is a big one, where everybody could have a voice, there would be a possibility of working it out.
Mm-hmm. And now that I know what the plan was, I'm on board with this idea. But you didn't tell me that was what the plan was before you did this.
Right.
You know, or at least if you did tell people that that was what the plan was, you didn't tell enough people, because not enough people were on board with the idea. You've got to get evangelists. You know, you have to share it with people who get excited about the idea, and then they share it with people. And the next thing you know, everybody's excited about the idea. But if you just put cones up on the freeway or on this expressway, nobody knows why they're there.
And I think it's the bigger principle is what we're talking about is like, can we invite each other to the table? You know, maybe somebody at the table has an even better idea.
Yeah.
You know, instead of the people that are in charge thinking they know the answer for everyone and they just have a right to impose it. And I think that's a lot of what we're suffering from, is really an addiction to power and control that doesn't leave room for other people to have a voice. And after a while, when people don't have a voice for a long time, they turn on themselves and they turn on each other and they turn against whoever is the overlord. And, you know, we can do better as a human race. And I think we can do way better as a country.
One of the most poignant and thought-provoking things I ever heard was somebody say that Middle Eastern terrorists think that they're the rebels and the United States is the evil empire from Star Wars. Mm-hmm. That was like, oh, that, because it's all about perspective.
Right. And we don't know what their conditioning is. The average person, I don't know what the conditioning is of a terrorist in the Middle East. I don't know what they've suffered. I don't know what they've been told. I don't know what their role models of behavior are. But I think it serves us to find out.
Yeah. Yeah. Rather than fighting with them, why don't we figure out why they hate us so much?
Right. And is there something we could be responsible for?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Isn't that part of the best relationship that you know, where you have a partner who's willing to be responsible for their part in what goes wrong, and that you're willing? And this is hard. I think this is one of the hardest things for human beings to say, you know, this was my contribution to that upset. Not just you did this and you did that and you're wrong and I have to convince you that you're wrong, but oh, maybe I could have handled that differently, or maybe I said something that was hurtful, or maybe I did something that was hurtful, or maybe I was ignoring you, or maybe blah, blah. That's one of the principles of healing relationship, is that we summon the strength to reflect on ourselves and stop blaming other people for everything.
This is a really fascinating conversation. So while you're doing your research for this latest book, what's the name of the book again?
It's called America in Therapy, and the subtitle is A New Approach to Hope and Healing for a Nation in Crisis.
Oh, that's a great title. All right. So while you're doing the research, what is something that surprised you? What surprised you the most while you were researching the book?
That's a really good question, because there were a lot of things that surprised me, but I'll just tell you a really good thing, because I think it's nice to throw something really good into the
mix. Yes, please, because this has been kind of a sour and dour conversation.
It's hard to face all those things. So one of the things that came up in my research was that, and I don't remember the number now because I don't have it in front of me, but the amount of volunteerism in America and philanthropy in America is very high. There are all kinds of people who volunteer their time to go into prisons and help prisoners, to work with families of prisoners, to go into the inner city and help people build gardens on their rooftops, you know, to create mobile libraries for people who don't have access to books. There are a million ways that people are kind to their neighbors. I mean, again, I wish I had the statistics in front of me, and I should keep some of them in front of me, but the billions of dollars that are donated to worthy causes to help other people. And then part of this article was translating the number of hours that people volunteer their time into the dollars that represents. And it was billions of dollars. And we're good people. People in their hearts are good. I believe in people. I believe that if we're given half a chance, we want to be loving and kind and constructive. And there's a lot of people who don't have half a chance. They really don't.
We're at the beginning of a new year. What can we do to make this year kinder, more peaceful?
You know, I always come back to us. Just us as individuals. And I've told this story many times, but I'll tell it again. My husband and I were out to dinner with my daughter, who's an adult, and we had a waitress who was just very unfriendly and unpleasant. And my daughter looked up at her and she said, "Are you having a bad day?" And she melted. She didn't really tell us what was going on, but she said yes. And from that moment on, she was totally pleasant and kind. And you know what? I think that changed her whole day, just to have somebody care.
She was seen.
She was seen. She was not judged. We didn't, you know, nobody went to the manager and said, "We have a crappy waitress." She was like treated like a human being. And one of the things that I know so much from being a therapist is You know, I have heard so many stories of horrible abuse and neglect that people have suffered in their childhoods. And you don't know if that person is your waiter that night. Maybe they're doing everything they can do to just hang on. And we can make people's day by just being kind, by being appreciative, by seeing them, by acknowledging them for whatever they do. And it's free.
Yeah, it is free. Being kind is free. Good job, Mom, on raising a good daughter.
She had a lot to do with it, too.
I think we could all set a New Year's resolution right now at this very moment to be kinder to people.
Totally. Totally.
I mean, that's one that we can keep.
Right? We all want that, right?
Yeah. Just see people.
Yeah. And you want to be seen. And when somebody, you know, my ex-mother-in-law just passed away. She was 96 years old. And I stayed close to her for her, you know, all of her life. And she was a wonderful woman. And one of the things that was so wonderful about her was that when you walked into the room, she lit up. She was so happy to see you. And you know what? Again, it costs nothing to welcome each other. And I can tell you from my heart how good that felt.
Yeah.
Time.
Yeah. Well, that's a good story. Okay, this is a business podcast. So let's talk about the actual process of publishing and writing your book and getting it out there and telling people about it. What's the hardest part about being an author?
You know, I think there's a lot of hard parts about being an author. The most important thing is that you have something you just really want to say, and it's going to get you through the hard parts. And so, you know, I want to present that. I had a fabulous writing coach and editor that I worked with on this book, and she would always say, come back to your why. Come back to your why. Why are you doing this? Why are you having the podcast? Why are you writing this book? There's something deep inside a person that really wants to express something, share something, give something, do something. But the hardest parts were, writing the book was hard. It was really hard.
And I imagine it might have been a little heartbreaking too. I mean, the topic is heartbreaking.
The topic is heartbreaking. And I think I've had a lot of that heartbreak being a therapist, you know, and you kind of learn to deal with that. I still remember this session. I had a little girl that I was working with. I think she was no more than five. Her parents were divorced. They were highly conflictual, and they had had a knockdown, drag out fight. And someone called social services and took this little girl to a foster home. Mm. And she was devastated, devastated. And I remember finding that out and having a hard time going home and being with my kids, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, and they worked it out, and she got back with her mom. And I don't know what they did, you know, they figured it out. But there is a lot of heartache. There are stories that I've heard from clients of what they've suffered in their childhood that you would not believe. They seem like worse than what you've, you know, a bad movie. So I think I've learned to focus on the love. I've learned to focus on the good we can do for each other. I've learned to focus on that healing is possible. And I've had people come to me for therapy whose abuse is so bad that I knew I was the only person holding light for them. Mm-hmm. And it was an honor.
Yeah.
I've had people come to therapy who no one ever said they loved them or cared about them.
Oh my God.
And it's really true. And it's not uncommon. And so, you know, I focus on the love part. So writing the book, really, it wasn't so much the pain. It was like, can I help? Can I do my part to help in this world? You know, my one part, you do your part. And there's millions of people out there really trying to do their part. So I consider myself in good company. From a business point of view, you know, it's the publishing world is very difficult right now. That's what I understand. And that's what I know from the people in the field. It's very difficult to get published. A lot of people are self-publishing. Publishers do less and less. The author has to do more and more to market themselves and their ideas. And I think I just took that on, you know, because it's just a commitment. There's been times where I've like, why did I ever do this? There are times where I'm like, why did I ever do this? I don't know if I can do it. But my why keeps me going. It really does. Yeah. And I was very fortunate to find a publisher very quickly. And I know that's not the case for everyone. So I count myself very lucky.
Offer some advice to an author who is looking to actually be published by a publisher, because that is, that's like, what is it, 5% of books are actually published by a publisher these days? I don't know. That number is probably really wrong, but
I don't know either. I think, you know, I would say one thing I would say is I had incredibly fabulous coaching and editing. I don't think it's something you do alone.
Yeah.
I had written before I found the person that I worked with. I had written 120,000 words in this book and I didn't know what to do with it. I had all these like separate chapters. I didn't have any way to put them together. I didn't know what I was doing. I was very blessed to find this person pretty quickly, recommended by somebody who recommended her. And in our first call, she saw the vision of my book and she saw a vision that was bigger than mine. And so I would just say, find expert coaching help, find expert editorial help, because you want to have, if you have a message and you really care about it, you want it to come out the very best that it can. And I think, you know, I think with all that help that I got, and I feel like I have a strong message because I believe in my message and it's my experience. You know, I feel like I was very fortunate to have a publisher. And I think you got to stand out today.
Yeah. Well, your topic is timely and meaningful too.
Thank you.
Do you want to give a shout out to the woman you worked with?
Yes, I absolutely do. Her name is Ashley Mansour, Mansour. And her business is called, she calls herself the LA Writing Coach, Los Angeles Writing Coach. And you can find her under her name, Ashley Mansour, and she's fabulous. And if you're out there and you want to write a book and you don't think you can do it, or you don't know how to do it, Ashley takes you from ground zero. And I want to tell you, I had 120,000 words. I told you already written. And one of the things she told me in our first phone call was most of the authors that I work with don't use what they've already written. And
wow.
I was like, there's no way I'm going to use what I already wrote. Well, guess what? I wrote my book from scratch.
You considered it research.
And it's a much better book because I listened to the coaching advice. And you
followed your psychotherapy advice too.
Right,
you listened.
Right.
I'm going to take a gander that your favorite marketing tool tip or technique is to listen.
You really have to do that if you're a therapist. You do. And you know what? I do know what a gift that is, because I know that when I've really felt heard, there's just nothing like it. There's nothing like it.
We need to wrap up, and I'd like to take a moment to thank my audience. So the 2023 Spotify Wrapped for Podcasters just came out. And according to Spotify, there are five Spotify listeners who listen to Gratitude Geek more than any other podcast. And if you are one of those five people, I would like to tell you that you are fantastic. You are groovy and you are so appreciated. Thank you. So now about you. What about you, Phyllis? This is your moment of gratitude. For whom and what are you most grateful?
Well, I am grateful to you for being on this podcast. I am most grateful to have a very loving and wonderful husband. I have three beautiful children. I have three beautiful grandchildren. I have beautiful friends. I live in an incredible place. And I just want to say to your listeners, I started out a very unhappy person. And I never knew the life that I have right now was possible. And it's because I did so much healing work that these doors opened for me. So if you need help, get it, because there's just nothing like it. And it's nothing to be ashamed of. It takes great strength and courage to get help and use it. So that's what I want to say. I'm grateful to be an American. I'm grateful to be alive, you know, all of that. And I'm grateful for this whole podcast format, because I think it's an incredible service to people that bypasses social media and the news outlets, where we can just really hear people talk about things that are really substantive, meaningful, and helpful.
I don't normally talk after you give your moment of gratitude, but I would like to share for the audience that about 7 years ago, I was in a really dark place. I was angry at everybody and I sought help, and it was exactly what I needed to do. Don't be afraid to ask for help.
Absolutely.
Last word.
And if the person you go to isn't the right person, go to somebody else. Don't give up.
Thanks for tuning in to Gratitude Geek, the relationship marketing podcast for micropreneurs, building genuine, lasting relationships with clients, colleagues, and community. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe and leave a review on Audible, iTunes, Good Pods, or your preferred podcast player. Even Spotify. Our theme music is track 14 by Rev Brock and Soul Lily. Make sure to visit gratitudegeek.com for the show notes, where you can find links to the resources we've mentioned, including ways to connect with our guest, Phyllis Levitt. I've been your host, Candace Ridardi. Stay groovy, my friends.
Stay groovy, my friends. We need you.